I have to say I'm really thrilled to introduce this session. It does continue our theme at the Advisory Council of considering the really important strategic matter of the effect of technology on the future of accounting, corporate reporting, and quite frankly, everything we do at the IFRS Foundation. The session is in fact split into two distinct but clearly related sessions. The first session is really going to challenge our thinking with our external presentation from Anthony Jenkins. We will then break for some digestion time before we are really challenged again to work in our smaller groups to consider some of the specific key challenges facing the IFRS Foundation, using what we have heard from Anthony as our platform to consider those. It is an important and topical matter for the Foundation, and your strategic thinking around the topic, really valuable input for the Foundation as a whole. So, Anthony Jenkins. Anthony is a founder and executive chair of, and I don't know whether I'm going to pronounce this right or not, 10 times? 10X. It was one of the two, and I was going to say 10X, and someone else said, no, it's 10 times. 10X Future Technologies Limited, a company that promises to redefine how banks operate and engage with customers. Anthony's focus on driving innovation in the digital economy also extends to his role as Group Chairman of Currencies Direct, the leading UK non-bank provider of foreign exchange and international payment services, and his role as a board member of Blockchain, the world's leading SAT software platform for digital assets. He sits on the Digital Advisory Council of Fannie Mae and is a member of the Consultative Working Group of ESMA. Anthony is a strong believer in the need for businesses to support the future workforce to acquire the right skills to thrive in the digital era. His commitment to mobilizing ethical and responsible business practices is recognized in his role as chairman of Business of the, in the Community, the Prince of Wales Responsible Business Network, and chair of the Institute of Apprenticeships, an organization established to promote high-quality apprenticeships by 2020. He was previously the group CEO of Barclays PLC for 3 years until July 2015, and he holds an MA from Oxford University and an MBA from Cranfield. Anthony, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thanks for that warm introduction. And it's a real pleasure to be here in London. I want to discuss four things, really to help stimulate thinking. These are basically my views of the world. You can debate whether they're right or not, but I think the underlying facts and logic are broadly correct. The first thing I want to talk to you about is what's really happening with technology. I mean, technology affects every aspect of our lives, and yet we don't think about it very much. So what's really going on with technology? Secondly, I'd like to give you an example specifically from my area of expertise, financial services, and talk to you about how technology is changing financial services. I'd then like to talk to you about a difficult but important topic, and that is the challenge of incumbency. And that is the incumbents in any established industry or set of activities. So that could be as a regulator, as a professional service firm, as a financial services firm. And finally, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, what can we do about this tsunami of technology change, which is coming at us much faster than we can actually detect in our everyday lives. So let's move to the first topic. What's really going on with technology? If you think about it, the smartphone is 10 years old. Mass adoption of the internet is probably 20 years old. Broadband communication as we know it is probably 7 years old. So these technologies haven't been with us for very long, certainly in all of our lifetimes. And for our children and grandchildren, those technologies will have always been with them. And the most important thing to understand, and if there's one thing that you take away from this session, I'd like you to think about how the power of technology is increasing at an increasing rate. What this means is that the cost of doing anything with technology is getting cheaper geometrically. And of course, the capability of technology is increasing. So if you think about a service like the sorts of things you can do on your phone now, very difficult to do those things without cloud computing. Cloud computing is impossible to do without lots of cheap computing power. GPS technology, broadband, and so on, these technologies allow us to do things today which we couldn't have imagined doing 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. A small example from my own career, in the mid-90s, I was working in corporate cash management in the United States, and we wanted to launch a new service to provide receivables processing for corporations. The essence of this was that invoices would be digitized and then presented to a central processing factory where a decision would be made to pay them or not. The entire business case hinged on whether we could afford one T1 line, which in those days cost millions of dollars. And we reworked the business case several times. We found that actually we could afford one T1 line. But then somebody realized we actually needed to have two T1 lines because you needed one for redundancy. So we had to go back and do the business case again. Now you can rent a T1 line for about $200 a month. So as these technologies change, they empower things in our lives which we couldn't previously have imagined. Now, there's lots of things going on with technology, but there are three things that I really want to call out as being very important transformational underlying technologies, which it is worth investing the time to understand. The first is artificial intelligence. A lot has been talked about artificial intelligence, and there's a lot of myths about artificial intelligence. For the last 30 or 40 years, we've used technology to run complex statistical modeling. Artificial intelligence is not that. If you think about a matrix where one axis is the degree of machine activity versus human activity, and another axis is the degree of machine autonomy, then artificial intelligence is in the top right-hand corner. In other words, little human intervention and a high degree of autonomy. What this allows is very complex problem solving, sometimes in ways that human beings can't imagine. Now, when you think about artificial intelligence, it's easy to go to a scary place where software robots take over the world, and perhaps we'll approach the singularity, as it's known, where artificial intelligence surpasses human capability. But we don't even have to imagine that to see what artificial intelligence is capable of doing today. You'll all be familiar with the DeepMind project around the game Go. The interesting thing about the game Go was not that the machine beat the human Go player, the best Go player in the world. It was that the machine was able to derive strategies which were counterintuitive to human beings. And actually, in doing so, created a better outcome. Apparently, there's a great new movie out about this, and it's well worth going to see. I haven't seen it yet, but it's highly recommended. So artificial intelligence, even before we get to the singularity, is going to be very important in taking decisions that were previously taken by human beings. This applies in many different areas of our lives. Most prosaically, of course, in things like customer service, where chatbots can now replace a lot of what humans would do, but increasingly in the areas of medicine, where machines can make more consistent and better informed decisions. Education, where they can make better and more informed and more scalable interventions than human beings can do. This is not necessarily about, at this stage, replacing human beings, but it is about augmenting human beings. As we go down the road, though, you can envisage a world in which you could see a heavy degree of replacement of human beings by artificial intelligence. The next thing I want to call out is the Internet of Things, or IoT. The Internet of Things is basically the injection of microsensors into everything that affects our lives. Now, quite complex pieces of machinery like jet engines have had these capabilities for a long time. And often examples are used of, you know, my fridge is going to have a set of sensors in it, so when I need some milk, it'll go and buy me a carton of milk from somewhere or other. And those applications are actually one end clearly working today, at the other end quite banal. But most importantly, if you think about supply chain management, the ability to track at any point in time where a container loads of goods is, and then to use that to create a set of financing technology, that is going to be very, very important. And the third and most important technology to think about is distributed ledger technology, sometimes known as blockchain, although blockchain is only one version of distributed ledger technology. There has been a lot of coverage of cryptocurrencies. You will note that cryptocurrencies have soared in value. They have become an asset class. People are skeptical about cryptocurrencies. They think there is a bubble going through the cryptocurrency space. There certainly is. But that doesn't mean that the underlying technology isn't fundamentally important. And if you think about what distributed ledger technology allows you to do, it basically allows you to cryptographically record and protect and transfer ownership. So these technologies are being used now for fine art, for diamonds. They're being looked at in the space of educational qualification for real estate in countries that don't have well-defined property rights and mechanisms for recording property rights, and of course in the cryptocurrency and financial space. One of the most interesting phenomena going on right now is the so-called ICO space. This is where startups are effectively issuing equity using these types of technologies. If these things seem to you to be slightly arcane and a little bit futuristic, they are not. They are real technologies, they are viable technologies, and they are beginning to affect our lives now, and they will affect our lives much more profoundly in the future. It's a well-known phrase in the futurology business that we tend to overestimate the impact of technology in the short term and overestimate it in the longer term. But of course, the short term becomes the long term. One of the most important things that you see around the debate on autonomous vehicles is if you go back 10 years, knowledgeable people were basically saying we don't expect to see autonomous vehicles in our lifetime. Now autonomous vehicles are likely to happen sometime in the early part of the 2020s. My car, which I bought last year, is capable of maintaining its position and speed on the highway without any human intervention. Although, because it's a German car, I'm very polite. If I take my hands off the steering wheel, it politely asks me to put them back on the steering wheel. But we're not that far away from that kind of technology creating profound impacts in our lives. Now, to date, technology has allowed us to do things that we couldn't do before, and previously to augment human capital. And this is true in every revolution that we've seen. But in this fourth industrial revolution, it seems to me far from clear that we're going to be in a world in which technology augments human capability. We may, in fact, see a world in which it replaces human capability. And this presents a series of very interesting challenges for the world. And you can see two possible outcomes here. Reality, of course, is it will lie somewhere between the extremes that I'm going to describe now. But the first is a utopian view in which basically machines create increasing productivity and GDP growth within the economy. Human beings can finally take more leisure, so instead of working 5 days a week, we now work 3 days a week or 2 days a week. We have more leisure time, and we can use technology to allow us to experience the world in completely different ways. We can use technology to educate ourselves on everything from learning a language to deboning a chicken. We can use virtual reality to travel to places in the world which we can never actually get to ourselves. Perhaps we need some sort of universal basic income funded by a tax on the machines. All these are ideas that you will have heard of. But in that scenario, you can imagine a world in which mankind's well-being is enhanced and nurtured by technology. But there is also an opposite scenario to that, a dystopian scenario, a scenario in which basically the economy is hollowed out. All the work in the middle that requires some human judgment is automated, and what's left is at one end of the spectrum work that isn't cost-effective to automate, and at the other end, quite a lot of high-end work involving technology, but done by very, very few people. And if you think about what's driving inequality, a concern in many parts of the world, I believe that this technology effect is a contributor to that. We are seeing the leading edge of this phenomenon. And in my closing remarks, I'll come back to talk to you about what we might do about that. Again, in your own area of expertise and activity, think about how these underlying technologies may affect the work that you and your organizations do and how you can respond to it. Now, I'd like to get a little bit more specific and talk about financial services. Many of you will be familiar with fintech, and in fact, fintech really dates back to the middle of the last decade, but gained momentum in the last 3 or 4 years. 2 years ago, I gave a speech at Chatham House where I talked about approaching the Uber moment in financial services, by which I meant a point at which technology becomes transformational. And I laid out a series of timelines around that. I think we are at what I would describe as the end of the beginning in fintech. In other words, we've seen that fintech is not, in fact, a bubble, but is a viable way of re-engineering the financial services sector. And if you look across very specific verticals like low-value foreign exchange payments, peer-to-peer lending, wealth management, regtech, all these are areas where financial technology businesses are beginning to gain traction. At the same time, of course, the incumbents have not been slow to apply this new technology themselves. And we've seen around the world massive deployment of new technologies like mobile banking. Unfortunately for the incumbents, of course, they're building these new technologies on legacy technologies which go back many decades. If you look inside a big bank's technology organization, some of you have probably done this, it's not pretty. In many ways, it's like a museum of technology. You've got everything from big mainframe data centers through mid-range to server-based systems. All of these things are very difficult to move at pace. And this has allowed fintechs with a very narrow focus on creating a better customer experience at lower cost to begin to enter into the market. Now, you may say, well, yes, but we haven't really seen a Google or an Amazon in financial services, and you're correct. But I gave a speech at Ernst & Young there just across the way here recently, and they had done a survey where they had looked at consumers in 20 different countries. One in six consumers was using a product from a fintech. One in six. So this trend is starting to gain traction. We're at the end of the beginning. We're moving into the second phase. In the second phase, I think what we'll see is the fintechs continue to gain traction, but also the incumbents will gain traction too. Mobile banking has created a much better customer experience. When I was at Barclays, we did some studies to look at how customers used various channels. On average, a customer used a branch about twice a month. They used a call center about twice a month. They used internet banking about twice a month. Clearly not the same customer, by the way. They used mobile 25 to 30 times a month. A totally different customer experience created by the immediacy of the mobile experience. What this has done has led to a rather significant fall in branch traffic. In this country, 40% of branch traffic has fallen since 2011. Similarly, technologies like contactless technology mean that cash usage is falling and cash out of ATMs is falling in this country. What does that mean? Well, back to my earlier discussion, what it means is that if you're in the retail banking business, your job prospects aren't looking so good. In the speech, I predicted that somewhere between 20 and 50% of jobs would go out of the industry in the next decade and half of branches would be closed. I think I underestimated. And that is challenging because those jobs were relatively well-paid jobs with good prospects. If your branch traffic falls by 40%, you clearly need 40% less people. You may need even less people than that. But there's a third and very interesting dimension to this, which is about a totally different banking system. Now, our banking system has been around for hundreds of years. And basically, it's predicated on a system of intermediation. If it were just you and I in the world, and you had money and I needed money, we would arrange that between us. But because there's millions and billions of people in the world, we need a financial system to intermediate. This is true whether you're an individual or whether you're a large corporate institution, a financial institution, or indeed a nation. And that process of intermediation is expensive, because where you have intermediation, you have trapped risk. This is not about risk being eliminated. Risk is always there. But where you have a banking system, that risk crystallizes. And we saw that in the financial crisis. So what happens is regulators rightly require banks to hold capital against that risk. And that capital is expensive in the system. So in this third phase, which I think is somewhere between 5 and 20 years away, we can imagine a fundamental re-architecting of the banking system where large parts of this intermediation function are eliminated completely. And to bring that alive, and to just draw on some of the technologies I referenced before, I'd like to give you the example of what I describe as a 10-minute mortgage. So let's imagine that Susan is our consumer. She has identified a flat she wants to buy, and she needs to finance it. So overnight, her personal financial manager, an intelligent agent running off artificial intelligence, has been out in the market looking for the best deal for Susan. The artificial intelligence agent identifies a mortgage offer from a pension fund, talking directly to the pension fund's artificial intelligence agent. They agree a set of terms, which is presented to Susan when she wakes up. Susan likes the deal and accepts it. Underlying that is a series of smart contracts based on distributed ledger technology, which essentially recognize Susan's ownership of the property and the mortgage against it. That is created instantaneously using distributed ledger technology. The ownership of the property is recorded, the mortgage is recorded, and the pension fund now has an instrument which they can trade in the secondary market should they choose to. Also, the contract contains a set of provisions around what happens should Susan default on her mortgage and how that will be handled. And those provisions will trigger automatically in the event of a late payment or default. That whole process took place without any human intervention and almost instantly. Now, is that fantasy? No, because every single capability that I've just described to you exists. I can show you businesses that have that capability today and are working on that experience. What's the net benefit of that? The net benefit of that is that the banking system has not intermediated that loan at all. There is no capital held against that loan. The risk is assumed by the pension fund, and Susan has to pay back her mortgage. It's also operationally super efficient. There are no intermediaries taking their cut in this process. In this country, again, 80% of mortgages are broked. And yet, almost all the product is a very similar product from very similar institutions. Consumers are paying for that. So you end up with a more transparent, more effective, lower cost system. And you can expand this example to include many other areas of activity, corporate bond raising, letters of credit, and so on. So these technologies, which I've been talking about at the start of my address, empower these sorts of changes in financial services. Now let me move to the challenge of the incumbents. Why don't incumbents move more quickly? After all, banks have very large brands. They have hundreds of millions of dollars of technology budget. They have super smart people. They understand regulation. Why don't they move more quickly? And the answer to that is really a cultural and human issue. Large organizations are architected to protect themselves. That is what they are designed to do. And they perceive anything that looks non-traditional as a risk. But they miss sometimes the bigger existential risk that is out there of not moving faster. And I like to make the distinction between what I would call innovation, which is a linear progression of improvement of feature functionality, and transformation, which is a step change. And if you think about it, in many industries, incumbents are quite capable of innovation, but they are seldom capable of transformation. We see this in the automotive industry. Tesla, a startup focused heavily on electrically powered vehicles, in a way which was seen as something of a niche. Now, Tesla, which is a tiny automotive company by comparison to the big existing incumbents, has successfully shifted the strategic agenda from the automotive industry to the point where every big automotive manufacturer is now talking about turning their fleet into electrical vehicles or hybrids or both. And this is happening now at pace. Those companies will have those vehicles in the market in the early 2020s. So just a little bit over a decade since Tesla was founded, it's changed a complete industry. Now, why didn't the big auto manufacturers recognize that themselves? Because their mental mindset was around doing business in the established way. Another example that I particularly like is the Blockbuster example. Many of us will remember the days when there was a Blockbuster video store on every street corner. On a Friday night, you went down there, rented a video, maybe bought some popcorn, went home. But a little tiny company called Netflix started a business mailing DVDs to customers. Now, if you're sitting in Blockbuster and you see this happening, you're probably thinking, well, that sounds a really bad idea because I've got to think in advance about what DVD I want to watch over the weekend. And customers like coming into my stores to make a selection from everything that we've got. And we're on every street corner. We've got a massive brand and so on. And so you do what incumbents always do. You are in denial about the threat presented by Netflix. Now, Netflix, meanwhile, you know, starts to get established, becomes something of a brand, maybe still a bit of a niche product. And so at Blockbuster, you notice this, and the next thing you do is say, okay, well, there's obviously a market for a Netflix-like product, so why don't we do our own? Because we're Blockbuster. We've got a massive brand. We've got a huge supply chain. We've got leverage with the suppliers of content. We should be able to do it better than little tiny Netflix. And, of course, Blockbuster does that. But it's terrible, because what they do is they design a mail order version of their existing business. They don't rethink the business from the customer point of view. But the real point of transformation here is when cheap broadband becomes available and you can stream content from Netflix, as you now can from Amazon and so on. And one night I was sitting at home watching something on Netflix and I thought, this is absolutely amazing. There are millions of people around the world sitting at home streaming content. Think about the amount of bandwidth that you need to do that, and to do it at an effective price point is an example of what I said at the start, which is how the cost of technology falls. Now, of course, at that point, Netflix had the advantage because they had the brand, they had the customers, and Blockbuster vanished. But even more than that, think about what happened next. So Netflix is not just a distributor of content. It's now become a producer of content. Last year, Netflix produced $4 billion of content, which is more, by the way, than the whole business, than the whole budget of the BBC here in the UK, which includes everything, news, the whole thing. So they've not just disrupted the renting DVD industry, they've disrupted the whole content industry as well. And the reason why they were able to do that was because they had a maniacal focus on the customer experience and they leveraged new technologies to deliver a non-linear proposition. And one of the things that I would encourage you all to do, in addition to understanding what's going on a little bit with the underlying technology, you don't need to be a techie, you don't need to have to know how to write code, you just need to invest a bit of time in looking at what's happening with these technologies. How many people here have bought a Bitcoin or similar? Anybody? I have. Yes, you, sir, and at the back. If you haven't, you should. You don't have to buy a lot of them. Just buy it and see how it works. Learning and becoming familiar with these technologies is critical to be able to ask yourself the question, in whatever leadership role you have, is the right response for our organization a linear one around innovation or a non-linear one around transformation? And finally, I'd like to just conclude with a few remarks about what this tsunami of technology really means for society. And I really think there are very few things that governments and nations can do to ensure that they are successful in this new era. But those things have to start to happen now, because frankly, this technology change is as profound as climate change. And we know that as human beings, we tend to avoid having to do difficult things in the short term where there may be a long-term impact. But in my view, there are three things that need to happen. One, skilling becomes incredibly important. If you think about longevity, the good news is we're all living longer. Perhaps slightly good news, we'll all be working longer. And the skills that you obtain through your education, secondary and tertiary, are unlikely to be able to sustain you through a 60 or 70 year career. So continuously reskilling the population is the key to being successful in the new technology-driven economies. That's not just about hard skills. It's tempting to think that we should all learn to be coders. I don't agree with that. I think a lot of coding will be automated over time. But softer skills like collaboration, entrepreneurship, creativity. If you think about an arc that goes back to before the agrarian revolution, most people earn their living by creating value as individuals. It was only through the agrarian and industrial revolutions that organizations were created to deliver value, in which human beings became components in those organizations. I believe we're going back to a world where we have to be much more self-starting in terms of how we identify how we create value. And so in that world, people need to be able to think about enterprise. Secondarily, infrastructure is incredibly important. You can't watch your Netflix if you don't have lots of broadband capability. In this country, there are remote parts of the country which don't have that technology, but there are also parts of central London where you can't get high-speed broadband. If you look at the developing world, in countries like Africa and India, putting high-speed broadband across those countries, which is happening, is critical to their economic development. And governments can play a very important role in ensuring that the right infrastructure is built. And finally, legal and regulatory frameworks around digital become incredibly important. We don't have time here to talk about privacy, security, identity, who owns your data. If any of you used a contactless card to come here today in a taxi, is that your data? Is it the taxi driver's data? Is it your bank's data? Is it Visa MasterCard's data? Is it all of the above? None of the above? Who owns that data and who can monetize it? What rights to privacy do you have around that data? What about security around that data? These are real and profound issues, and the regulation and legal environments around them have to adapt and adapt at pace to a changing environment. So we've covered a lot of ground this morning. In conclusion, I would say the most important thing is to have a sensibility around technology, to recognize that the rate of technology change is accelerating, and to act as individuals, as leaders, and as citizens to make sure that that technology creates a utopian and not a dystopian outcome. Thank you very much indeed.
Anthony, absolutely fabulous. Thank you very much for that. We do have a few minutes for questions. And as I said earlier, if you can put your card up, and I'm also going to say to you all, please, can you put your cards so they're vaguely facing me so that I can actually vaguely see the names? And I'm going to ask the first question, Anthony, and thinking about the reason that we are all sitting here around accounting generally, but in particular the foundation. Do you have any particular thoughts on how what you've talked about in particular can affect accounting. Obviously, the distributed ledger has a key impact. Any other thoughts around accounting?
Yeah. So I, as you mentioned, I chair the board of Currencies Direct, a mid-sized private equity-backed company. For the last 2 years, our audit has been conducted entirely digitally. So the old days of people sitting there and ticking back invoices and so on, that hasn't happened with us. There's been 100% audit of every transaction through the business. Now, this creates a set of profound questions. Of course, for us, it's good because our audit theoretically ought to be cheaper. But for the profession, and this is true of all professions, by the way, not just accounting, but also law, financial services, and so on. In law, similar processes happen around discovery, where it begins to eliminate the sort of entry level for the profession. So how do people learn those skills going forward if you basically don't start at the bottom, but you start in the middle of the skill pyramid? And why is that important? Because one of the things that you gain as a human being is experience through doing those things, tedious though it was. In my early career, I spent lots of time doing tedious activities akin to ticking back invoices. But it gives you experience. It gives you an instinct. It gives you a sense of what's right and wrong, so that 20 years later on, when you're a very senior person in the profession and you're looking at a big complex problem, you've not just got a rational set of capabilities to draw on. You've got an instinct based on experience. And you might argue, well, that can all be automated away and the machines will have the instinct. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen soon enough. So I think the first thing for this profession is to think about how you embrace technology at the same time as making sure that people who work within it gain the skills that are necessary to deliver that. Secondarily, like all industries, my view is that embracing these new technologies, understanding them, figuring out what they mean, is not happening fast enough. Yeah. So the industries that you are involved in are moving very quickly. So you have to engage with these technologies. This discussion, for me, it's not a sort of topic of interest, right? It's not a sort of curiosity. This is going to change all of our lives and all of our professional lives in a very profound way. And it's incumbent upon all of us to form a view as to what those changes are and what we have to do about them. And it's hard because, for us, we grew up with the telephone, the telephone, the landline. That was the technology that has been there all our lives. Depending on which country you grew up in, maybe color television. In our lives, we've had, PCs, we've had smartphones, we've had the internet, all the other things we talked about. So we haven't grown up with these things. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage with them and really understand what they're about. They're not just for the millennials. These technologies are going to affect everything we do, and we need to understand them and figure out what it means for our business and our activities.
Okay, thank you for that. Giuseppe?
Thank you very much for your fascinating speech. You spoke about innovation or transformation in financial services. I would like to ask you, how would you characterize the state of affairs in financial service providers? Are they leaders or laggards with respect to other types of activities or industries? And why? I cannot hide my opinion. I think that financial services are laggards in this transformation. And it surprises me that we speak so much about technology now. Maybe the trigger has been the blockchain, because technology has been ongoing and transforming other industries for a while, at least in my opinion.
Thank you. It's an excellent question, if I might say so. I've spent an awful lot of time in my professional life thinking about this. As I mentioned, I was working in the United States in the mid-90s. In the late 90s, we had the whole dot-com revolution going through that. And at that time, the view was that, you know, bank branches were a thing of the past and everybody was going to do their banking online. Interestingly, in the period between 2000 and 2015, you know, if you walked down a street in Manhattan, there was a Starbucks, a bank branch, a Starbucks, a bank branch, a Starbucks. So instead of having fewer bank branches, in the US at least, there were more bank branches. And that's curious because you're right, technology has changed lots of aspects of our lives. And the only conclusion that I came to was that actually the technology hadn't evolved to a point and at a price point where it was possible to create that degree of transformation. But actually, I think we crossed over that point about 3 years ago. And so that sort of transformation is now possible. I would also say that the financial services industry, post the crisis, has been grappling with a number of very, very difficult issues. These things are all familiar to you. A massive collapse in trust in the industry. That is a global phenomenon. Big regulatory change, which means that more capital has to be held against it. A generally weaker macroeconomic environment. And if I'm honest, I think that banks themselves didn't embrace this because they didn't feel they had to. I have noticed an interesting change in the attitude of banks. I talked to a lot of banks globally. I was speaking to two yesterday, one on Friday. They are now waking up to the fact that they face an existential threat. And I would just say a little bit about regulation. You know, banks complain about regulation all the time, but actually it has presented a barrier to entry to date. I think that barrier to entry is becoming less powerful. And of course, technologies like cloud mean that you can process vast amounts of data at super low cost. And that's what banks have, vast amounts of data. If you want to understand the problem with the incumbents a little bit more, I would just share this anecdote with you. When I was running Barclays, I was frustrated that senior management didn't embrace this issue of change more quickly. And I was talking to one of my HR directors about this, and she made the following observation. She said, the thing you have to understand, Anthony, is that these people have spent 20, 25, 30 years doing this, and they have that much of their career left, and you're asking them to do something completely different. And that is very scary. Yeah? And yeah, we all reach a point in our careers, and I hesitate to say most of us in this room are probably at that point, yeah, where we've got that much career behind us and we've got that much ahead of us. And our natural human tendency is to be risk averse. That's not a criticism, it just is. But if we are to lead in this new era, we have to set that aside. We have to embrace where the world is going, not where it was or where we'd like it to be.
Thank you for that. Each time you speak, there's a new provocation for us to think about. Giath.
Thank you very much. Thanks. This is very thought-provoking and excellent presentation. Thank you for that. Just want to get your brain a little bit on the transformation you see for the banking system, financial system in general. The example of the AI and the mortgage is a very good example. But it seems that you are alluding somehow that this is will lead to separation of product that banks do now combined, so payment will be separate from investments. Investment probably is done directly, as you give an example. Other parts of the financial system will be providing payment system. So the whole basis of a depository institution, which is the hallmark of banking system now, seems to be transforming and probably disintegrating. And that's a whole paradigm shift in terms of regulatory and financial market infrastructure. How do you see this coming up?
Firstly, I'd have to say that predicting the future is very difficult because you're always wrong. So I'm not necessarily predicting the precise outcome that I described, but I do think that the combination of forces that we've discussed here today mean that you can contemplate a very different sort of banking system. Yeah. Has the banking system been sufficiently repaired post the crisis to ensure that, you know, we'll never have another crisis again? I don't know. I think actually if you look at the inherent nature of the banking system, fractional reserve banking creates a lot of risk, and maturity transformation creates a lot of risk, and those things have not completely managed in the reforms that have been made. At the same time, you know, there are faster, cheaper, better ways of doing things. And we're already seeing banks deploy digital solutions like Ripple as an alternative to using SWIFT, for example. Now, this presents a set of very interesting regulatory challenges, because it's not clear to me whether there's a situation in which the system can be entirely regulated in the way that it is today. So if you think about the internet itself, nobody really regulates the internet. There's a set of protocols that make the internet work, but there's no one, you know, global regulatory authority for the internet. It's literally transnational. Some nations have tried to block their citizens' access to the internet with, you know, with varying degrees of success and so on. So I think this provokes a set of very interesting regulatory challenges. My observation is that the regulators are very aware of this. They broadly see these new technologies as an opportunity, not a threat. But they are watchful of where some of these things are going to go. And if you end up in a world where, you know, a cryptocurrency, for example, if a cryptocurrency really did gain traction and became a vehicle for international trade, you could see a world in which a great deal of friction and cost was eliminated from the system. But how would you police that? So I think the answer is that the technologies present a whole new category of challenges that people need to get their heads around. And the conversation that I alluded to at the end of my remarks, which is we could have a whole another hour on this one, which is, you know, security, privacy, identity, data ownership, that's a whole nother category of regulatory issues. And it verges with the financial system, because if you think about what the financial system really is it's about identity of individuals or organizations. And it's about data, because all a financial transaction is at the end of the day is a bunch of data.
Thank you. We have, obviously, that has promoted a number of thoughts from you. We have three more people with questions. So, Paul, you first.
Thank you. Your speech was fascinating, very stimulating, so thank you for that. My question builds on some aspect of your last comment, and distributed ledger technology, blockchain. I've often heard that that's going to bring enhanced assurance between transactions and greater security. I'm struggling to see how, just because I don't understand the technology, and I wonder if you could just provide a couple of minutes on why this does bring enhanced assurance and security to transactions.
In essence, the way the technology works is a cryptographically protected and immutable record of a transaction, which is recorded in multiple different places. To use a very simple example, as opposed to having a bank account where today your money resides in the bank account, you can look at your bank statement. You would have a wallet in which your money sits. It doesn't sit any other place than your wallet, on your phone, for example. And then if you wanted to move that money around, you simply make an instruction that transfers it out of one wallet into another wallet without passing through the set of intermediaries that exist in the banking system today. And because this information is distributed, it's inherently more secure. Because it's also a chain, you can theoretically look at progress of that item through its lifespan. So you could do this if you wanted to for money. So you could look at who owned that money since its creation, or for a piece of art or a diamond or a container full of goods.
That's slightly counterintuitive, yeah. Isn't it? Because if it's distributed, do you think it's available to more people, is my sort of immediate sort of thought.
It's distributed, and therefore it's held in more than one place, so it's harder to lose. But of course, you can only access it if you have the keys, so it's more secure. Now, one thing that we ought to remember is, in my personal view, anything that human beings can build, human beings can destroy. And as we've seen in life, every new technology is simultaneously used for great good and great evil. And you know, I'm sure there are lots of people working hard at how to crack the cryptography around blockchain at the moment. And you know, there is one view that as the computing power increases and increases and increasing, that will be computationally possible at some point. So I'm always skeptical of absolutes. But certainly, relatively speaking, I think these technologies offer a different way of doing things, a lower cost way of doing things, and a more secure way of doing things. Let me just give you an example, completely nothing to do with financial services. One of the issues that we have today is qualifications. So when you apply for a job, you assert you've had a whole bunch of qualifications. Your employer then has to go and check that you actually have those qualifications. That's an expensive process. You usually pay a third party to do it. They have to contact universities and so on. What if it were possible to record on a distributed ledger your qualifications in a wallet that you control, and then you can permission third parties to access it? So when you go for a job, you can permission that third party to access your wallet. They can look at all of your qualifications. You can add to them through your lifetime and so on. So you have an immutable record of your educational qualifications. That's a big cost saving. It's immutable, so people can't alter it. And it's cryptographically protected. So those sort of use cases are nothing to do with financial services, but a good example of how the technology can be deployed.
And Paul, I think you've given an example of Anthony saying that we all should try to, you know, not being experts, but try to understand some of these things and the impact. And I know that I've done a few things on distributed technology, you know, ledgers, and you know, each time I get a little bit more learning, but it's intuitively feels, as someone who's very much at the end of their career, really, really hard. But, you know, I encourage us all to persevere because it is coming, and I think that example of the qualifications is a great example. And you know, the key to me is it's immutable. Nobody can change it. You know, once it's there, nobody can change it. Quite how the technology works on that is beyond me, but that's beside the point. Alain.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that very good and sort of far-sighted presentation. I share a lot of the sort of the pointers you've given, and in my own job previously I was responsible for trying to bring public procurement into electronic procurement, and I was part of the team that initiated the electronic invoicing directive in the Commission, and I'm now in charge of a team that's dealing, amongst other things, with the digitization of regulated information under the Transparency Directive. So I'm quite an enthusiast, don't get me wrong. But one of the things that struck me is that you didn't talk about cybersecurity, maybe if you did, it was rather in passing. And one of the risks with technology, if it becomes ubiquitous, and I think the distributed ledger technology in particular is a good candidate for that, is that if it breaks, we really are up the creek. A good example of that is a few days ago, a countryman of mine announced that he'd found a flaw in WPA2, the Wi-Fi, the protocol through which all of your Wi-Fi connections that you think today are secure is actually no longer secure and is potentially vulnerable to all kinds of attacks. And you know, can you maybe say a few words about the risks and how we need to think about that?
Well, clearly, and I deliberately didn't go into these areas only because of time, really. As I said before, you know, all technologies through history have been used for great good and great evil, and there are a range of threat actors in the security space, from state-sponsored, organized crime, disaffected people who are just curious, and also, frankly, the biggest threat is from internal users of the systems. And there's many ways to create a disruption through cybersecurity. Some of them are just simple forms of social engineering. People who attempt to gain bits and bobs of information, put it all together, and get access to systems. So it is a very real risk. It requires constant vigilance. It is at the top of every organization's risk register because everybody is dependent on technology. But frankly, I don't see how you can avoid the march forward of progress. And therefore, as progress goes forward, you need to be continually upgrading the security environments in which you operate. And to think, as I said, not just about the pure technical things about, you know, do I have the right firewalls and that sort of thing, but to think about the social and human side of it, because that's often where the vulnerability is. And the threat vector is often not the CEO in an organization, it's the CEO's PA. Tends to, you know, people think administrative assistants have lower levels of security on their system, but they shouldn't. They should have had, you know, super high levels of security. So it's a real issue. It needs to be at the top of everybody's list, but I don't see a way around it, frankly, because this technology is here to stay. Not very comfortable, I accept.
And our final question before I think we thank Anthony and break for morning tea. Aziz.
I'm really very scared. Because there is no frontiers. The state are dead. They cannot regulate everything. Creating money was a state privilege. Now with Bitcoin, there is no central bank controlling everything, anything. I wonder if the sole actors of the planet that used to be the state are not being fragilized. And I wonder if it wouldn't be a good option to take the opportunity of this technology to fill the gap. There are a lot of gaps. There are people who don't know what it means to have a word pass to work on a computer. Wouldn't it be a first agenda to fill the gap, to compensate, to try to reach out? Because if not, the world will be divided more. The world has been doing very well. We had access to everything that was invented, had the chance to be disseminated. But this, what is happening is really very frightening. I'm sorry, but thank you very much for your enlightening presentation. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I spend half my time in a state of optimism and half my time in a state of despair about where all this goes. Because I think both outcomes are entirely possible. And we can see a situation in which technology becomes incredibly empowering for humanity, and we can see a situation in which it becomes beneficial to a few. And your point about the state is an excellent point. It's easier to control physical things because you can control them geographically. Digital things are much, much harder to control. And you're also right about the creation of money. Now, one of the things about, of course, digital currencies is they are not fiat currencies. You know, they are finite in their supply. And of course, the danger when you allow governments to create money is, you know, you're trusting them to create money in the right way. So I think it is incumbent upon all of us, whatever role we have, whether we're in politics, in business, in governmental organizations, to think hard about how these changes are going to impact the world and what we can do to make them positive, not negative. I will go back to what I said before. I believe we're already seeing some of the negative consequences of technology. We're also seeing some of the positive ones. It's up to us to make sure that the positives outweigh the negatives.
Thank you, Anthony. And as is, I think, a very good question and comment to end this session on, and I think, you know, Anthony said it a couple of times, us, all of us in this room are leaders. It is incumbent on all of us in our leadership role to make sure that, A, we understand it enough to take our leadership and make sure that it is a positive impact, and the infrastructure is really, really key. As Anthony says, even in the middle of London, but in far-off places that are not the middle of London, to make sure that this technology is accessible to everybody, so that everybody has an opportunity to do it. So I think it's a great point on which to leave the discussion for us to have some digestion time, and that comment, I'm going to use it a few times from a conference that I went on last week that talked about that our human brain, as opposed to the artificial side of it, in terms of our experience, needs time to digest things and think about things as we then go forward into applying it. But I really would, Anthony, I think that has been very thought-provoking. Our next session, and I'm not sure if you're able to stay for that, but you're certainly welcome to do so. Perhaps join us for morning tea. Anyway, we are going to think about what you've said as a platform in terms of the implications specifically for the foundation. So I think you've given us a great insight into that and made us think and challenge ourselves as to how we go forward. So everybody, if you could join in me in thanking Anthony.